Welcome Underground, and to the first in an occasional series where we go through each of Terry Pratchett's novels to see what they can tell us about what's really going on here. In this introduction, we discuss why a novelist from the 80s writing about wizards and dragons has had such a profound intellectual impact on both of us, and how fantasy and folklore can help us get closer to the truth. Enjoy.
When did you first read Terry Pratchett?
I think I was 12. Like a lot of my favourite authors, I sort of came across him by accident. I think I was living on a barracks somewhere, and the local library was selling a whole load of books, or giving them away, actually, because they do that. It seems libraries, you know, clear space for beanbags and computers.
So this wasn't
what libraries.
This wasn't a military library.
I don't think so. The one I got, because the cover looked nice, was Pyramids, which is an unusual place to start. And I read it and I was like, yeah, that's all right.
Were you there as a 12-year-old making this decision completely independently, or was Mother there?
Mother was definitely there, but she hadn't read any Terry Pratchett either.
Right, okay, so this really was, you were just taking a dive, taking a shot, taking a bite.
Exactly, I mean, she was... There's a certain brand of kind of sci-fi fantasy that she does secretly like. There's a series of books called The Dragon Riders of Pern, which is about this kind of like medieval and they're riding dragons, except it's in the future and the dragons fulfill some social role.
I mean, I suppose that's why I asked that question, just because I kind of had your mum sort of, you know, pegged as a bit of a sort of fantasy reader.
She reads a lot, but not much of it is fantasy.
Okay.
It's normally, you know, P.G. Woodhouse kind of thing.
Yeah.
A lot of comfort reading, but like really a high volume of comfort reading.
Yeah.
She knows what she likes and is beyond the point of wanting to expand that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy with that. And I think that Terry Pratchett is one of those authors, isn't he, that is there's volume and there's a lot of comfort and you can just kind of bathe in it for... By the time you've read all of them, you've forgotten the first one. So it's perfect for that kind of...
Yeah, thing. And I've done the full run a few times.
I still haven't done the full run.
Never done them sequentially.
I've read about two-thirds of his Discworld novels. I haven't read them all.
What?
Yeah, I haven't read them all. And it's because I'm really, really rationing them. It's because it's such a treat to get a new one. You know,
I used to do that with Ian M. Banks. I would save them for when I was taking long flights. And so it took me a while to work through, because there are only like eight of them or something like that.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, a lot fewer than Terry Pratchett.
It's so sad, isn't it, that he died. He really, really shouldn't have died.
Well, they're both of them.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. So yeah, okay, so you're really, really taking a punt and you bought Pyramids. Now, that's one that I have read, obviously.
Yeah, and you'll attest it's an unusual place to start.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very unusual place to start. Yeah.
And it's one of the few standalones, actually. Because most of the books are part of kind of mini series within the series. Mm. You've got the kind of guards books, which is eight of them, the witches, you've got the Industrial Revolution, the wizards.
Yeah.
Death.
Yeah.
And then you've got Pyramids, which is about a pharaoh who becomes an assassin.
Well, it's kind of, it stands apart. I mean, it stands apart. I would say it's quite appropriate because, I mean, Egypt in its own way sort of stands apart as an ecologically unique civilization. So it's quite fitting that, you know, it should stand apart in the Discworld as well, both kind of literally and metaphorically. So there's my two thoughts on Pyramids.
Yeah, exactly.
Very profound for you immediately. The profound level has gone up to 10.
Where do you go from here?
I don't know.
But yeah, well, when I was 12, I wasn't very fussy about... Well, books I read, I just read any old really that got given to me.
Yeah.
So long as it wasn't like the sort of book you're supposed to read or the book that adults want you to read.
Yeah.
and thankfully, Terry Pratchett wasn't one of them.
No.
I enjoyed it, but like a lot of the kind of authors I really like, I read the first one, started at a completely random place in the series. I was like, oh, that's all right. And then it was probably a year before I read another one.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, by the time... I'd read, you know, three or four. Yeah, I was completely hooked. Mm. And by that point, yeah, I own them all. And they're all hardbacks from the age of 14 onwards because I'd read up to there and was buying them as they came out.
Yeah. Well, I think that what's really interesting about Terry Pratchett, I mean, that article that I sent you, that speech is a transcript of a speech that he himself delivered.
To the Folklore Society.
Yeah, about, you know, about his work and about the Discworld. And he said that, you know, stories have got to be told. You know, as a journalist, you learn that the reader is an active participant. Mm. And I think a little bit like, I actually think it's quite similar with Ian M. Banks, but when reading Terry Pratchett, you know, it's not actually a passive thing.
He
trains his reader over time, and you develop, you kind of grow towards him as a reader through experience.
But also, I mean, yeah, you know, I mentioned, yeah, you know, I've read some of them six times, I think. But obviously, you're reading a Terry Pratchett book when you're 12 is very different to reading a Terry Pratchett book when you're you know, approaching middle age. you can just engage them on a few different levels.
Yes, well, because I mean they're so shrewd about life that there's so much life experience in there that isn't actually. Yeah. And what's interesting is that I think, as Terry Pratchett himself would say, that life experience is not all his, but it's that kind of accumulated, aggregated life experience that you get through sort of folklore. That is there as a very deep, deep well of observation and wisdom. That's what he's so good at, isn't it?
All his stories feel ancient, I think, some level.
So, of course, you know, every time you come back to it at a different age, you're going to be poking around in different bits of the coal seam.
Yeah, exactly. And when you're 12, it's just a plot. Just enjoy the plot at the object level.
But also the kind of the motifs and the... You know, it's got those kind of archetypal, excellent bits. Yeah, you know, they're all great stories because they're just...
Yeah.
It's just your mainlining archetypes, aren't you, really?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which he's even, discussed at the meta level in Witches Abroad, which is all about the witches trying to control the strands of ancient storylines that are whizzing around the world.
Yeah.
Have you read that one?
No, but there's a bit in The Colour of Magic where he talks about stories, and they're like, they're blowing free through the universe and they have to be kind of pinned down. And so it's absolutely brilliant.
So he really goes in on that in Witches Abroad. The whole plot is about these witches who are trying to craft the world into storylines, so then they control the outcome because they know how the story's going to end. So you kind of create the preconditions that fit a pattern.
Nice.
So it's almost like you're actively trying to set up things that fit with archetypes, because then they're entirely predictable in how they play out.
And I suppose that you can see that happening when you're reading it as a 12-year-old, because you're drawn to it and you're fascinated by it. But it's not actually it's not obvious to you as a 12-year-old why. And nor is it obvious to even an experienced and intelligent third-party observer why actually a 12-year-old would be really fascinated by that story rather than that story. And it's because, you know, it's corresponding to those deep patterns that somehow underlie our perception of the world. And you sort of resonate with that even when you haven't had the life experience to kind of backfill the content of why you resonate with it. Yeah. that in itself is a kind of fascinating dynamic, isn't it? But that's true. That's true of all stories, all good stories.
All good stories. It's the ones that last.
But
many don't.
But Pratchett is so good at just distilling a huge tradition of folklore, particularly English folklore, into these brilliant, unique, imaginative and inventive stories in the Discworld.
Yeah, although I think compared to most modern authors, he also had a decent amount of life experience. I mean, the first few years of his career, he fit in a lot more than most people who now go to writing school and then just start writing books and, you know.
Yeah. Didn't he always work for wasn't he a sort of nuclear engineer or something? Is that right?
No, so I think his tragedy was he always wanted to be an astronomer but didn't get the grades. And an amusing thing underlying Terry Pratchett as a writer is that, you know, he's one of the cleverest or wisest writers out there, you know, who I've ever read. But, you know, he got a D in physics, and, you know, he clearly wasn't academically clever, or he was clever in a way that wasn't measurable by the system.
Well, he probably wasn't explaining he probably wasn't very good at explaining the theories in dry, sort of empirical language, was he? He was probably telling a story about quantum mechanics or something like that, and telling an absolutely brilliant story, but it probably didn't fit the mark scheme, if I had to guess.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. And I imagine you can, as someone with experience in marking students against her.
Well, yeah. I, you know, a tangent is good. A tangent's always good. Especially in ancient Greek, where it takes the heat off me to know what the sort of strong Irish root is. Anyway, he was a frustrated astronomer.
Who then became a journalist at 16, but on the kind of local beat. So I think he'd always joke that he saw his first dead body within, you know, 3 hours of starting. And so I think just as a kind of cub reporter in a regional newspaper, you see a lot of life very quickly. So he later became a PR officer for the Nuclear Energy Board.
Right, yeah.
Just as Long Island and then Chernobyl were happening, if they hadn't in that order. So he had a bit of that. But his background is, yeah, local journalism, where you get... Well, he credited it for his ability to just get stuff on paper, you know, work to deadline, just turn stuff into stories.
He was in the Mendips, wasn't he? In the Chiltern Hills, is that right? Between Oxford and London?
I don't know if that's where he started, but that's where he ended.
Oh, right, okay. Yeah. Where did he start? Well, we have to Google it.
That's a Google. Where was Terry Pratchett born? That'll be a brief pause. Beaconsfield, Buckinghamshire.
Buckinghamshire.
And then he ended up near Salisbury. So Beaconsfield is near High Wycombe. So you're absolutely right. That is Chilton's kind of thing, isn't it? I don't really know that part of the world.
No, which is why I'm typing in Buckinghamshire right now into Google. Yeah. Well, my point is that he's there in the Chilterns, and I would describe that as an in-between bit of England. You know, it's in between Oxford and London, isn't it? So it's one of those little in-between spaces where there's a lot of farms and a lot of hills and a lot of villages. There's rich and there's poor, but it's not really specifically anywhere. It's in between. And I think that it's in those spaces in England that, that really interesting stuff often happens. You know,
agreed. And I guess it's weird to have it so close to London, but you're absolutely right. I mean... You know, where I hail from in the West Country, it gets weirder, but it's further away, of course. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's why I loved the West Country when we moved there when I was 14. So I wasn't West Country born and bred, but as soon as we got there, I absolutely loved it because I felt like I was in an in between space where there was a little bit more freedom and a lot more interesting stuff, you know, going on. It's kind of in the air. So I wonder whether... I think that that's a big part of Pratchett, isn't it? That he is from those in-between spaces where those traditions and there's just stuff happening that's just deep and goes back a long way. You scratch the surface and it's actually quite deep.
And then he was living at the end of that. In that address to the Folklore Society, he's of note with sadness that people are kind of just forgetting these ancient stories and traditions and things like that. That used to be the stuff that just everyone knew because you learned it by osmosis. And now, actually, when do your 8-year-olds learn about all the weird stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this in the pub yesterday when we were sitting next to this couple, a pair of couples who had met up for lunch, obviously friends. And they were kind of our parents' generation, very thick West Country accents. So living, you know, 5-10 miles outside of Bath. And all they talked about in these kind of thick West Country accents in this quite, you know, deep rural pub that was so deep and rural that it still had carpets, you know, it was pre-gastro. And so, you know, you think, if you're going to overhear some interesting stuff anywhere, this was it, you know, this is where you would hear the interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And all they talked about was the cruises that they'd been on. And they were just listing out the stops of the cruise ship. And then the other one would list out the stops of their cruise ship. I was just there thinking, it's like, why don't you just list out the stops your train made on like the way into London? Like, you haven't actually visited anything. Anyway, but the point is that that's what they were talking about. They weren't talking about, you know, anything to do with the real life in the area that they lived, or anything to do with, you know,
the land, the traditions, the
environment that they were embedded in. Because they're not really in culturally embedded in the land at all, that generation, our parents' generation, or at least they, you know, that those, a lot of them aren't. And I think that, you know, I have lots of things to say about that generation, but I think that that's one of the big issues that they have, is that they're untethered and atomized. You know, there was that novel by Michelle Holbeck about called Atomized, that's supposed to be very profound.
I've read about it.
Yeah, 20th century sort of French, very, very pessimistic analysis of this sort of generation. But I think it's right. I think that atomizes.
But also that generation has broken the chain, because, again, exactly. Once you lose this stuff, it's very difficult to pick up again.
Yeah, and I think that's why they're all so desperately depressed in their unbelievably, you know, rolling around in all of that unearned money. Just unbelievably depressed and lost. I feel sorry for them, but it's tragic. You know, I should have been listening to some really interesting conversations there, and I wasn't.
You got to dig pretty deep. There's a place in the West Country where you can overhear stuff, where there's still mummery and there's still Morris dancing and there's some weird stuff that happens in Midsummer, but not in a kind of Instagram way or in a kind of bullshit druids way. But in a real way.
You're right. And I think that's where I've always been drawn to the West Country, is because you do get the sense that those pockets are still there.
And how you can't fully lose touch of it when you've got, you know, barrows everywhere.
No, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful for that kind of stuff, isn't it? I mean, I remember last summer I was just going on a bike ride and off Route 24 down to Bristol, and there's this unbelievable, I think it's Neolithic stone barrow tomb that you can just, there's nobody there. You just go into it. I mean,
they're everywhere.
Unbelievably creepy going in there. But at the same time, I mean, you're kind of like, it's like going into the womb of England or something, you know, or not even England, sort of Britain, you know, because pre-England. And it's a very profound experience. You think, God, this has been here a long time.
There's one next to my parents' old house where the dog wouldn't go anywhere near it. Yeah. Sort of terrified of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that kind of thing, that sense of kind of deep connection to the land. I don't know. I think that most people would view that with a bit of suspicion these days, wouldn't they? That's a kind of bit of a problem.
Well, it's unsafe, I think, in some ways.
Mm.
It's out of control. It's chaotic.
Well, it's pretty rational.
Yeah. But also something that you feel much more strongly than anything rational.
Yeah, it kind of very much overrides any kind of progressive rational feelings. however you might define them. Which doesn't mean that it's in conflict with them. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying it's necessarily in conflict with any rational things. I'm just saying that it's more powerful than they are. And that's what's dangerous about it, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's just hard to see a modern person just releasing themselves into this kind of, you know, putting themselves into one of these narratives or ceremonies. I've got a book called The Scouring of the White Horse, which is an account of something used to be done on one of the white horses. I forget which one, every decade or something like that.
Yeah.
You get the whole village out and you clean into all the weeds and you replace some of the chalk and stuff like that. And they've been doing this time immemorial, and it's a big thing for the whole community, and you know, have a, you know, roast a cow or something afterwards, and big party, no one gets wasted. Extremely wholesome and community binding. You just can't imagine that event happening today. It'd be organized or ticketed, or there'd be lots of people in high-vis vests, you know, controlling it, and there'd be a committee.
Well, you'd have to file a form or a lot of forms with the council.
Yeah, and there'd be insurance and
there'd be risk assessments.
And you need individuals to have responsibility for it. It can't just be, you know...
Yeah, legal responsibility.
The people.
Yeah.
And so, it's actually impossible to see how these ancient ceremonies can happen in a public manner. you know, perhaps in a private manner or a secret manner, but
yeah, no, you're
right.
Getting
the whole community together.
There just isn't the legal cultural space for it. I mean, in many ways, it is actually our legal system and the sort of the growth of the legal system, our imperialistic legal system that that does squeeze out a lot of what life used to consist of.
Yeah, and it's telling, again, the bit of the West Country I spent a lot of time in, that there's before the M4 came through and after the M4 came through. And as soon as the M4 came through, you know, you are now under the control of the state to a far greater extent than ever before.
Yeah.
You were no longer, you know, 2 days ride from London. You were 2 hours. The traffic's okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, to bring it back to Terry Pratchett, I mean, maybe this is why... This is why he's so appealing, is that he offers this sense of rich connection to a tradition where for which there just isn't space in the rest of life anymore.
Yeah, do you think that's specifically in the Witches books, which are obviously the most embedded in that kind of folklore vibe, being about, you know, witches in a village in the Ramtop Mountains, and dealing a lot with the traditions and with the stories.
No, I don't actually, because I think that, well, obviously death, the character of death and the books that are about death, I mean, that, you know, that's obviously dealing with one of the deepest elements of human life. And I think that most deep cultural traditions in some way are, you know, quite fundamentally related to death or mortality. So the death ones do. I think that the ones that are that are more about the city, I think the Discworld, you know, you could do another division of the Discworld novels, couldn't you, to Ad Urbem and Rus, so, you know, the ones in the city and the ones in the countryside. So the ones that are set in the city are, you know, they're to do with city life, which actually is very old. It's obviously not as old as country life, but, well, actually, I suppose that if we're thinking about country life as something that grows out of the agricultural revolution, actually city life is pretty much as old as country life. You've never really had one without the other. In fact, you just haven't had one without the other, because there is no country until there's a city. There's just the world.
There's just living,
undifferentiated.
That's an interesting point. And you also get a lot of his books actually where it's the country people going to the city, like Masquerade, or the city people going to the country, like Fifth Elephant.
Yes, and when the wizards go to the wedding in Lanka as well. Yeah, so
of course,
so I think that those ones, what I'm saying is that I think that the folklore of the city is just as old as the folklore of the country, and the issues of the city are just as old as the issues of the country. And so I think that we associate folklore now with the country, but that's because the country is obviously less connected and less vulnerable to modernity. So it's like it's, you know, the city is it erases.
City moves much more quickly.
So it erases its own memory much faster.
Well, that can make the history feel a lot deeper, because it's a, you know, much higher resolution, because you get 10 years of history in a few weeks if you compare the city to the country.
But I think, overall what I'm saying is I think the books that are set in the city, the City Watch, the Industrial Revolution ones, are actually just as kind of profound in dealing with human stories and human issues and human nature. And in that sense, they tick all of the criteria for folklore. It doesn't have that that sense of permanence or longevity of the tradition, but that's because of the nature of the city. Does that make sense?
It does, and I think particularly in the first books, because it was always notable how things always felt a bit eternal in the Ramtops or the more rural ones. Well, whilst in the certainly in the early books set in the city, you have a constant turnover of, you know, the chief wizard or the whoever's running the city or the head of the guard.
And he really, focuses in on that as well, because, you know, if you remember the opening scene to The Colour of Magic, the very first book, is the whole city burning down.
Yeah.
and he says, it doesn't really make a difference. It's just a sort of a fiery punctuation mark in the history of the city. You know, it just all burns down and it's just building up again, you know, no problem. So, you know, the city, he very much is very specific that the city is a place of constant change.
Yeah.
Constant change. Whereas, you know, the whole thing about Lanker is that it kind of doesn't, or it's very resistant to change. Very resistant to change. Which is one of those kind of like little sort of profound insight. Is that, you know, there, what he's done there is he's distilled something that's true about city life and something that's true about country life into its real essence.
Yeah. And page you're burning down your main city. Of a 50 book series.
And just absolutely nailed it.
Yeah.
And it's, but without being explicit about it. It's just a part of the story.
It's the background. It doesn't even drive the plot.
I mean, it comes out of the plot, but it doesn't sort of drive the plot. It's just a reason why Rincewind is running out of the city. It's just So I mean, there in a nutshell, you have the brilliance.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, if there's one weakness of the books as they get later on, is that there's less of this change. He feels much more constricted by this universe he's created, and he can't just burn down a city anymore.
Yeah.
Because there are just too many threads going into it, coming out of it.
And that's the face of all mythological cycles, really, isn't it? That over time, they ossify. You know, they start out...
They get filled up and formalized.
Living and vibrant and dynamic, and they get, over time, they become formalized and ossified.
Because it's amazing, it's... rereading The Colour of Magic, the first book of the series, and it's all over the place. Like, whilst later on, like, it's all pretty set down. We have our cast of characters we know well, we have our locations we know well.
Yeah.
And you're almost playing with the established relationships rather than just creating new stuff out of whole cloth.
Yeah, I mean, he throws out things in The Colour of Magic, you know, the counterweight consonant, for one thing. You know, like, he makes big claims about that. It's like, you know, and it doesn't really show. Am I right in thinking the counterweight consonant doesn't really show up in the rest of the Discworld?
It's called Interesting Times.
Does it?
That whole book is set in...
is it?
In the counterweight consonant,
I've got smart. See, this is it. I've got more to read.
Yeah, I know. I'm shocked and appalled you haven't read them all.
Well, I think one of the reasons why I want to do this sort of series on going through each one book by book is I want to retain a little bit of fresh eyes as we go through. I haven't read them all, and I'm looking forward to having that kind of first experience of them and then being able to talk to someone who's, you know, read them six times.
Tell me, how did you get into Terry Pratchett? Where was your starting point and why?
I think my starting point was... I might have been given one as a gift when I was in my late teens, and I might have read it a bit like you and been like, okay, that's fine. But I think it was when we lived together and you were basically, you would occasionally say these things about Terry Pratchett that suggested, you know, you have a deep love and deep affinity.
He comes up a lot.
Yeah. And I thought, I should probably read these or at least read a few more of them. And it's a bit like... it's a bit like Ian M. Banks and, you know, the culture novels in there. Actually, it took me a while. It did take me a while. Mm. You know, when you first read them, they can come across as quite sort of frenetic and quite episodic. You know, there's always something mad happening. You know, there's never a break, really, in a Terry Pratchett novel between kind of quite crazy things going on. And I found that sometimes I found it quite difficult to just keep track of what was happening and you know, in that kind of lazy reader way that one sometimes can be. And I found that a bit of a challenge at first, but over time, as he trained me as a reader in his style and I got used to it and you know, came to understand it and get a grip on it, you develop that deep affinity for it, and it is like being able to get into a hot bath of familiarity, and you just sink in, and it's wonderful. And that's happened really over the last 10 years, and I've sort of maybe read one new one per year, perhaps, yeah, over the last 10 years, which brings me to the point I'm at now. I've probably read, I don't know, 12 to 15. I'm not even entirely sure how many I've read. But I have deliberately withheld from just chainsawing through all of them because I do enjoy them so much.
Yeah, also they're quite resistant to chainsawing, I find. I don't binge read them in the same way that I can binge read other authors.
I think it's because they're so episodic in the way that they are written.
Well, especially the early ones. But also, yeah. I mean, they kind of float around for a bit in your mind, I think. Or you know.
Yeah.
You can read them very quickly. They're not long books, but then they kind of hang around.
Yeah, they're very... it's like they're very highly compressed computer files, and reading it is like sort of unzipping it or extracting it or something like that. And yeah, it grows in your mind even after you've finished the book. The story is still whirling around in your mind and is still growing and expanding. It's like a sort of a mushroom cloud that sort of still expands quite a long time after the actual explosive reading event.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would agree with that. I think that you can't read another one while that process of expansion is still happening, because it would cause a sort of a interference pattern or something.
And I guess they're also all quite self-contained, apart from the first two. It's not like you're left with some kind of cliffhanger that needs resolving, or you want to hear what happens to the character next. And of course, you can't hear what happens to the character next, because you'll then go and write the next book will be a guards one when you've just been into a witch's one or something like that. There isn't that kind of momentum between books. They all
You're right.
Stand alone reasonably well.
Yeah. And that's from that kind of quality of, you know, he has a quality of permanence about the world and the characters. There is this quality of permanence that one gets the sense that they're still there. Even when you're not reading the books, they're still there.
Yeah, you're just seeing some episodes from their life, but you're just seeing the highlights. Yeah. And the whole world is written in such a way that, this is going on.
It's there, it's happening. Yeah. You know, the great Arthurin is flying through space and all this kind of crazy shit is happening. So you don't get that sense of, oh my God, I need to find out what happens to this person.
Yeah.
So you're like, it's like, well, whatever's happening in... Well, what they are doing now is what they're supposed to be doing, is what their character... Of course, I already know what Rincewind is doing right now. I know what he's doing right now.
Yeah.
He's in a bar. He's in a pub. He's in the leaky drum or whatever it is. And he's sort of cowering whenever a barbarian comes in, and then he's getting into scrapes and getting out of them through sheer luck. And, and that's what he's doing. I know what he's doing.
Yeah.
I don't need to read it to find out.
Yeah, we don't need to hear about every single scrape.
No. I know what Death is doing. He's sort of pondering things in his black garden.
So what's your favourite Terry Pratchett book? Of the mere 12 you've read?
Yeah, I think the one that stuck in my mind most of all the ones I've read was Equal Rights. Because I think...
That's an early one.
Yeah. Because I just think it is such a brilliant, just so brilliant in its exploration of men and women and their relationships and their... the meaning of being a man and the meaning of being a woman and the meaning of the relationship between the two and it's so real and so well observed, but of course it's all done through, witches and wizards who are of course explicitly not real.
but I guess it goes back to your folklore point, because I think Terry Pratchett deals a lot, I think, with gender roles and things like that, and it's all because that stuff is... a lot of folklore is about that. Folklore encodes in it, what it is to lead a good life, and it generally has different opinions for what that is if you're a man or a woman.
Mm.
And you get different narratives and different...
It's different stories, isn't it? It's a different story.
Yeah.
It's part of the same meta story.
Yeah.
Which is the story of...
And they're all complementary.
Yeah, they're all complementary. It's part of the same meta story, but there's sort of different subplots. And I think that people don't like that. I think that, this is where the dangerousness, dangerous because it sounds like, it sounds constrictive. It sounds as if you were just somebody who hadn't read the books and you were just listening to this, you might think, oh, so he thinks that, you know, women have a role and men have a role. And it sounds very, constrictive and authoritarian and blah, 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 blah. But it really, really isn't in the way that he explores it and the way that it's presented. Because,
well, there's a warmth and a love that goes through all his books. And I think what Terry Pratchett sees and then tells stories about it is that, yeah, everyone is having real human experiences and deserving of compassion. He's also a very generous spirited writer.
You're right. And he comes across as an observer rather than somebody who is telling you what the world should be like. He is not one of those writers who's telling you what your life should be like or telling you what the world should be like. He's somebody who's just wryly observing the world, and you kind of just can't help but observe along with him. I mean, that's kind of what reading one of his books is like, sort of standing beside him and seeing the world kind of mediated through his own eyes. And you can't help but be like, yeah, you're right. Yeah, spot on. Yep, that is dead right. Yeah, that is absolutely right. The experience of reading one of his books is not the experience of being told what to do or told what to think. It's the experience.
Yeah, definitely not told what to think. Yeah,
it's the experience of being able to observe, you know, just reality, just through kind of a very, very special refractive prism. And I think that's the wisdom element, isn't it? He's not clever, although he is. But more fundamentally, he's wise. It's the wisdom of the books that makes them really good.
Yeah, and do you think it's important to being able to communicate this wisdom that it's set in a fantasy world rather than, you know, the real world or historical world?
It's a really good question.
I heard him once describe writing in fantasy, because he took a bit of heat for this. You know, you're so clever, why do you write books about dragons? And he said that writing fantasy is like writing a book set in the real world. It's like when you are, you know, six and you get one of those boxes of watercolors and it's got like eight colors in it, you know, green, yellow, black, brown, whatever. And then you get the deluxe box that has some extra colors, like, you know, gold and purple. And he says that... writing fantasy is like having this deluxe box where you just have these extra colours you can paint with.
Yeah. octarine. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely right. It's the colour of magic, octarine, for anybody who hasn't read the books. You should be reading them already if you haven't. I mean, it's a really, really great question. I'll read you what I wrote. I was just typing out my thoughts about the colour of magic, because obviously we're going to do a podcast on the first book and then every book in order. The first bit of my notes for The Colour of Magic reads that the Agatian Emperor's Grand Vizier is called Nine Turning Mirrors. And this is an apt name for the Discworld series itself. It bounces around reflections of reality within itself, shining them back at unexpected angles and giving glimpses of all sorts of fantastical things. So I think that what fantasy allows you to do is it allows you to play. And I think that by playing, you can look at things from more angles than you can through, you know, being serious and not playing.
Or you can take a dynamic that's well understood under normal circumstances and put it under more unusual circumstances and see how it plays out.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, by putting
see what you learn.
Yes, exactly. By putting something in a different setting, or by putting it in a different, decontextualizing it and recontextualizing it, you automatically highlight things that are not normally at the fore, or you see new things, and it's being able to put on fresh eyes to see the same the things that you see every day. And I think that, you know, the fantasy setting is the fresh eyes. So I think that fantasy is an important element in that respect. Do I think that it's Do I think that you have to write in fantasy in order to achieve that kind of effect? No, I don't think so. But I think that fantasy is a very, very powerful, good way of doing it.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable answer? What do you think?
I think it works. But what's quite funny is the whole series kind of start off as a parody of the fantasy tropes, as much as anything else, and it just happened to be really good. Because, <Yeah. laughs> I mean, again, we'll get onto that in our first episode of the series, talking about Colour of Magic, but it is just a whole load of mictakes of the standard fantasy tropes just layered onto each other, strung into a pretty vague narrative.
Yeah.
But somehow it not only manages to tell you more about the sort of sources he's working from a, you know, like Conan the Barbarian or whatever, but he just somehow makes it really true to like real life as well.
Well, I think that in a way, I think that what happened, and you're going to have to go with me here. I'm a classicist by trade and by training. If the main sort of works of the classics, if you look at the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, ancient epic poems, if they were written today, they would be classed as fantasy. They would be a genre works. They would be fantasy. Mm. They'd be in Waterstones alongside Terry Pratchett. And
I also heard magical realism.
I was afraid I'll have to disagree with you there, because magical realism is more like Murakami and Borges and stuff like that, which is magical realism is it sets itself up as real but sort of
with some glitter.
The things occasionally go weird at certain points in the story, but the story isn't set in a fantasy world or an unreal. I think fantasy is actually quite different from magical realism. But anyway, that's sort of by the by. But my point is that the Aeneid is set in, and the Odyssey and the Iliad, the Odyssey and the Aeneid are set in worlds where you have harpies and these mythical monsters and things, cyclopses and giants and all of that going down into the underworld where you meet the spirits and magic swords and golden boughs and fate and the gods and destiny and all of these things that are all in Terry Pratchett and all in a lot of fantasy novels.
I'd always assumed with those ancient Greek myths that's generally kind of what people thought was happening just over the horizon or three villages across. It's like you just hear the tales told by sailors or travellers, and for all you care, 200 miles away there might be a dragon.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And I think that you're onto something there, because the question I was going to ask is that what happened to stop basically just normal, what happened to change normal literature or the highest form of literature, epic, into something that's a genre, in a tucked away part of the bookshop where you sort of furtively go, not quite as furtively into the sort of, adult bookshop, but still a little bit furtively, you think...
There's some crossover as well.
You feel slightly ashamed to be buying a book on witches and wizards, possibly, if you're young and callow. I mean, now as we're approaching middle age, as you put it, perhaps we're the self-conscious bit.
Exactly. When you're 12, you do it happily. When you're 30, you do it happily. But when you're 19, it's a step.
Furtive. And so what happens to change, the highest form of cultural expression into this kind of slightly culturally suspicious niche genre? And I think that there's lots of different answers to that question, but something like in the Enlightenment, empiricism, scientific revolution, the change in the 1700s, where suddenly the novel as it developed was set in a very empirical, scientific, naturalistic world where the supernatural.
Yeah, naturalism became a big thing, didn't it? I haven't studied this in any depth, but all the kind of great Victorian novels are so naturalistic, they're very boring, I find.
Yeah. But
you're not talking about great deeds, you're talking about, an annoying family or, a rich person.
And maybe Protestantism has something to do with it as well, the sort of the deliberate exclusion from, the the good life or the correct life of superstition and spirits and fairies and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And the intellectual chasm that opens up between, you know, science, enlightenment, naturalism, and the old world of, you know, these kind of superstitions and stories and what they might call popery.
Yeah, and then there's a sort of value judgment put on it. You know, the stuff you can measure and do experiments with is valuable, and the stuff you can't is not valuable.
What I would say is that when fantasy was sort of invented with Conan the Barbarian and Tolkien in the 20th century, it was already a sort of artificial parody, because that intellectual schism had already been opened up between the living tradition of these stories and the culturally dominant worldview. And so when Terry Pratchett came along and decided to take the mick out of it, in a funny way, he kind of almost implicitly put himself, he found a way to bring it back into the main, or back into the, what am I trying to say? Back into the side of the intellectual angels. Because
and all of the bestseller lists, importantly, because then you have Terry Pratchett, and then in that Folklore Society lecture, he's bitching about having his place taken by Harry Potter. But obviously, probably the two best-selling authors of the UK. Harry Potter and Terry Pratchett.
Because he's a modern man, he's post-Enlightenment, he's, you know, he was all those things. He's
extremely as his later work around around voluntary euthanasia and dementia. You know, he's extremely, you know, a rationalist.
Yeah, and so by sort of, by taking the mick out of the artificially revived tradition, he somehow brought the tradition somehow onto the cultural mainstream, but through a sort of judo flip or something. You know, something that's quite odd. You know, almost by looking at a reflection of a reflection, it suddenly stops being a reflection again. Or something like that, you know. So I haven't articulated that very well, but I think there's something like that.
Well, there's something there to explore, because at the same time, in taking the mick out of all the standard fantasy tropes, he creates extremely believable characters who you really get behind. And so they start off being, an absurd Conan the Barbarian parody or a Lovecraft parody or a, you know, it wouldn't be funny if you know, the guards in the background in a Conan novel actually had, you know, hopes and dreams.
Maybe this is the way to articulate it. You know, when you get Tolkien and you get Conan the Barbarian, they're dealing in caricatures, because they have self-consciously resurrected something. And in order to do that, you have to do it with caricatures. If you take the mick out of a caricature, you do it by pointing out the reality that would actually be there instead of the caricature.
Yeah, by taking the ridiculous stuff to its logical conclusion.
Yes, and by doing that, you suddenly make it real again.
You accidentally made it believable and grounded.
Yeah, you sort of accidentally reverse engineered it back into reality, but still keeping all of the qualities of that tradition. I think that there's something like that that's going on.
Yeah, because the fact is that these, you know, the characters who are obviously ridiculous in the first couple of books, by the end, they mean quite a lot to you. The sort of Sam Vimeses and the Granny Weatherwaxes and whatever. It's like
I thought it was brilliant what he said in his lecture about how Granny Weatherwax is actually an evil witch, but she's too proud to be evil.
I mean, she's probably my favorite character in the whole thing. Yeah. And every time I'd read a new witch's book, I'd just be terrified he was going to kill her off, because she's always like right at death's door. He never quite does.
But I thought that I was like, God, you're right. I mean, of course he's right. It's his character. But I've read a lot of books with Granny Weatherwax in. I've always been like fascinated by her character, but I've never been able to put my finger on quite why she's such a brilliant character. And then he just absolutely hit the nail on the head. Like, she's an evil witch who's too proud to be evil. And you're like, that's absolutely right. It's just brilliant.
Yeah. But also, I mean, that goes into the general Terry Pratchett philosophy we'll explore over the series. But there's a difference between being nice and being good. Like, if you're just nice to people, that doesn't get the outcomes. You have to be a bit evil to do good. You have to be prepared to, you know, destroy stuff to say the nasty thing.
Yeah, you got to have hard boundaries.
Yeah.
Hard edges.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the world's just going to walk over you.
Yeah, and so you got to have strength as well. And
Yeah. Wisdom.
Wisdom.
Dangerous wisdom. Yeah. So why do we want to do the series then on Terry Pratchett? Why do we want to do a deep dive book by book? I guess what I think is that there's an incredibly rich seam of being able to talk about human life in every single one of these books. And it will only get more sophisticated and brilliant and deep, like stacking the books on top of each other.
Exactly. And there's so much it touches on. So it's such broad reference. And again, just, yeah, reading some of his, nonfiction, you end up buying 6 books on Amazon and then working out from there. Like all great books, it's a kind of starting point for wider thoughts.
And they're just fantastic stories with fantastic characters who are a pleasure. Yeah. It's just a pleasure to spend time in the company mentally of these characters and through them spending time with the great man himself in his prime.
Yeah, no, this is an excellent opportunity to read them all again.
Yeah,
which I haven't done for a couple of years now.
Yeah, yeah. And how many are there in total? Do you know off the top of your head? How many episodes are we committing to by doing this?
I think it's more than 40, less than 50. Oh, if we're just doing Discworld.
James, not more. That's how I'd feel about it. Very good.
41.
41. Well, it's going to be an epic.
Yeah.
Epic. Very good. Well, should we wrap it up then?
Let's wrap it up there. And we'll be returning to Terry Pratchett frequently.